Welcome to Legal Lens, a DebtWire podcast on legal issues impacting restructuring and the distressed industry at large. My name is Andy Serby. Today we're doing things a little bit differently, and we have a trio of attorneys from Clifford Chance to talk to us about a topic that spans the globe. Normally I would do a little bit of an intro, but since we have so many of our guests with us today, I think we'll let them do the intros for themselves. We'll start with you, Ilse.
Yes, hi, thanks. I'm Ilse van Gasteren. I'm a partner in the Amsterdam Restructuring Group.
Hi, my name is Maya Zurel-Fink, and I'm a partner in Clifford Chance's New York office.
Hi, my name is Melissa Coakley. I'm a partner in the restructuring team at Clifford Chance in London.
Fantastic. And like I said, I think we have a great topic today. We're talking about Chapter 11 and some major international alternatives to it and kind of how they relate to each other. For many years, Chapter 11 and UK restructuring schemes were sort of considered the major two global restructuring options. But over the past few years, we've seen a number of jurisdictions implement more sophisticated frameworks, often inspired by Chapter 11. Melissa and Ilse, can you start off by giving our listeners a quick history on some of the changes?
Yes, absolutely. The major one in the UK being the introduction of the so-called super scheme or restructuring plan during COVID. Unlike the scheme of arrangement, it allows for cross-class cramdown, and this has been really widely used since its introduction for both UK and foreign companies, including in contested situations such as Adler, McDermott, Cineworld, Thames Water.
The Dutch WOA was introduced in 2021, and it's a restructuring tool that is actually similar to the UK super scheme, but it has certain key differences, or shall we say benefits. So it offers a moratorium, and the voting threshold is only two-thirds majority, unlike the UK RPN scheme that requires 75%, for example. And we've seen a number of complex cross-border restructurings using the WOA, also in parallel with UK processes or Chapter 11 proceedings. An example is the WOA in the Chapter 11 for restructuring of Diebold Nixdorf. This is a US-based company which specializes in payment process services. In this case, the WOA was used because of a Dutch holding company in the structure and a debt for equity swap was needed, but also a Dutch moratorium. The WOA was in this case also recognized in the US through a Chapter 11 proceeding, which is a great basis for future parallel WOA Chapter 11 processes. And actually, the WOA has been gaining popularity, and it also allows non-Dutch entities to apply for it. So I expect that we will continue to see an increase in these parallel processes. And to be fair, because I'm talking about the Netherlands, but the WOA is not the only framework that has been gaining more trust from foreign investors. The WOA came into force as a result of a European directive, which required the member states to improve their restructuring tools. And this is also why, in the same period, for example, Germany launched its own tool called the Staruk, and France implemented a super scheme called the Sauvegarde Accélérée. And in each of those jurisdictions, the restructuring dynamics have quite significantly changed due to these new tools.
Perfect. And before we start comparing in-court processes, let's start, like most companies do, out of court. We've seen a trend of aggressive and, in lots of instances, creditor-led liability management transactions in the U.S. So at the same time, we've seen cooperation agreements aimed at bolstering creditor collective bargaining power against borrowers that have now made their way from the U.S. to Europe. Melissa, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's right. We're seeing an increasing number of LME transactions relating to European borrowers, slowly increasing compared to the U.S. At my last count, I'd seen around 20 since 2015. Big recent names include Honkermuller, Loperex, Intralot. But for England specifically, there are a few reasons why LMEs are not really being pursued by English companies, at least not yet. It's important to remember that one of the reasons LMEs were introduced in the US was as a tool to try to avoid using the expensive Chapter 11 process. In England, in contrast to Chapter 11, schemes and RPs can be used surgically, so the whole capital structure doesn't need to be included in the process, which significantly reduces cost and time. So given the flexibilities of these in-court processes, there's really little you could achieve via an out-of-court LME that you couldn't achieve within a scheme or an RP. And the benefit of using an in-court process is really the finality and the lower litigation risk post-transaction. So simply put, there is, at least on paper, less of a need for out-of-court LMEs here. The second reason is directors' duties. English directors in the zone of insolvency have duties to consider the interests of creditors as a whole and can be personally liable for losses if their actions worsen the position of creditors in a subsequent insolvency. So whether or not stakeholders agree there's a real risk, the obvious way to eliminate this risk is to use a court-based restructuring process, as I've just mentioned. And then turning to the point around cooperation agreements, lockups in the UK are really old school. Cooperation agreements, yes, we're seeing more of those now in various contexts, you know, where an LME might be on the horizon, and that's fine. And there's no issues really as to why they'd be unenforceable unless someone feels there are competition issues, which personally feels a stretch. I've never seen a lockup litigated, and frankly, I don't expect to see a co-op litigated either, at least not in my lifetime.
Yeah, I think adding to what Melissa just said, in the Netherlands, it's actually a similar position. So the loan documentation used in the Netherlands leaves more room for LMEs than some years ago, I would say. But the challenge still is the risk of prejudice to creditors, which is a concern to directors of Dutch companies from a director liability perspective. So LMEs are being looked at, but they're not frequently applied.
Going back to where it all started, there's no such concern about directors' duties, at least not so far. And liability management has been used in the States for a very long time, but it has really picked up in the last few years, at least perhaps in the creativity and sometimes, as you mentioned, aggressive nature of these transactions. And given that US investors are often involved in foreign companies, I'm not all that surprised that these transactions have now been gaining traction in Europe as well. What I don't think has fully landed in other jurisdictions is the litigation that often follow these transactions. And we now have a decent number of decisions in the US that can help predict what could happen and what to avoid when structuring these transactions. Ultimately, however, as I think we know, many companies using LMEs still ended up in Chapter 11. But the LME trend, I think, will continue given the availability of liquidity in the market and the desire to stay out of Chapter 11 for as long as possible. Finally, as far as cooperation agreements go, we've heard a lot in the last few years, and there's been a lot of speculation as to whether these will continue to be used. And it certainly will be interesting to see how creditors continue to use them and also how companies and sponsors attempt to limit their use going forward.
Great. And on to the in-court process. We're going to start first with the first thing that everyone thinks of when they talk Chapter 11, which is the automatic stay. Can you tell us how it plays out with abroad cases, starting with Melissa this time?
Yeah, so there's no per se automatic stay in a UK scheme or an RP. And in my view, my own view, this was the big drop when restructuring plans were introduced. And we remain very hopeful in the UK that the legislators might add it to the toolkit at some point, along with DIP financing. We do have already a separate moratorium procedure available on the statute books, but honestly, it looks like a Swiss cheese, except with more holes in terms of carve-outs, meaning it doesn't apply to most large cap restructuring situations. We just can't use it. That said, we find we can manage with traditional standstills and lockups in pure restructuring situations, given the schemes and restructuring plans usually take only under 4 months to implement, depending on whether they're appealed. In the event of an actual insolvency, we do have a moratorium in administration, which is all singing and all dancing.
Adding to this from the Dutch side, sort of BOA actually has, and I already mentioned it, an optional moratorium. It's for 8 months maximum, and it can be applied to all or part of the debtor's creditors, like the BOA itself. And it is actually used quite frequently. It has proven to be a very effective tool to allow the debtor to work on a WOA plan. In fact, in some cases, you can use parallel processes to solve the lack of moratorium. So we've seen an example of a shipping restructuring firm, which used the UK scheme to restructure the debts, but in parallel a WOA, mostly because the moratorium was needed to hold off dissenting creditors who had already started selling vessels by way of enforcement.
Going back to Chapter 11, the automatic stay is indeed one of its most important features. And I think the Chapter 11 automatic stay is still perceived as the most effective, especially when you have to implement it worldwide. That said, I think that the fact that it kicks in automatically and it applies to all stakeholders, unlike what we've heard from Melissa and Ilse, can also be a disadvantage compared to these other systems that are better equipped to restructure just certain classes of debt while the remainder of the business continues unaffected. For example, even when you're implementing a deal through a prepack, however short it is, and even when you're not impairing trade debt, you still have to notify all the creditors and so forth because there is a stay. And so it might be helpful, that, and that's just my opinion, to think about implementing something similar to the English scheme or RP, where the restructuring can be more surgical.
Now, let's move on to handling contracts and leases, because as we see more stress in areas like retail, that's become a really big part of a lot of Chapter 11s. Let's start with the US perspective on this one.
You're absolutely right on that point. This feature is one of the reasons why companies still use or have to use Chapter 11, even if an out-of-court option would be preferred. As you said, it's been used heavily. We've seen a lot of retail. There's hospitality, airlines, movie theaters, and I could go on. With companies where burdensome leases or contracts are a major factor, and the ability to reject, assume, or assume and assign such contracts or leases is very important to restructure the company's balance sheet.
An RP is a one-stop shop in terms of a process, and it can be used to achieve an operational restructuring in practice. It can be used to terminate contracts and terminate trade debts, but where a contract provides a property right, a straightforward termination is not possible. However, this is usually achieved in practice by giving landlords the option of a pretty bad deal, sometimes zero rent for a period or even always, or to terminate, which is a pretty easy choice. So we achieve it through other means. In the aviation or shipping field, this can have a Cape Town overlay, but is nonetheless also achievable in pretty much the same way. In administration, contract counterparties can continue to exercise contractual termination rights, even if they are essential suppliers. And in administration, leases cannot be forfeited without permission of the court or the consent of the administrator. The courts will consider if the lease continuing is required for the purposes of the administration. If the purpose is a rescue objective, it's highly possible forfeiture will not be allowed.
Under the VOA, debtor can propose amendments to burdensome operational contracts, such as leases. And the counterparty can, however, not be compelled to agree to such changes. But if the counterparty rejects, then the VOA allows for termination of the same contract, where that termination, for example, was otherwise not possible. Early termination penalties or damages can be restructured in the VOA as well. So this is a very important feature, but so far the feature has not been used very frequently. But it can be very useful to get rid of burdensome contracts if necessary. Should note that the VOA cannot be applied to employment contracts.
Right, and that's actually a notable difference from some of the uses in Chapter 11, where we see the rejection process applied to things like union deals. Next, I'm sure that all of our US listeners are generally familiar with the concept of the absolute priority rule in Chapter 11. For those that aren't, the absolute priority rule requires that every class of impaired creditors that have not voted in favor of the plan be paid in full before any junior class or claims of interest receive distributions. This often translates to equity getting wiped out in most cases. We more or less expect it. Is that the same in your jurisdictions abroad? Start with Ilse here.
You know, the answer is yes and no. The VOA has the APR. The concept is in there, but we can deviate from it. Basically, if this is necessary for the VOA plan to be implemented and provided that creditors are not prejudiced, and this is a test and an assessment that needs to be done by the Dutch court. There have already been a few cases where the shareholder was actually allowed to keep its equity stake, whilst creditors had to accept a write-off or an extension. But it normally does require such shareholder to contribute significantly to the VOA by funding the new money, for example. Otherwise, it will likely not work. In one case, the court had also commented that it approved the approach whereby the equity was entitled to hold on to its stake, because in that case, no one else was willing to provide the new money required. So basically, this means even though we have the APR concept as a starting point, it is possible to deviate from it in practice within certain boundaries.
The absolute priority rule doesn't apply in the UK in any strict sense. So this means that sponsors can retain ownership, but a departure from the strict entity priority model still needs careful consideration. And such sponsors typically would have to bring something to the party. Typically, this may be new money, but consideration could take other forms. In the past, the courts have been quite relaxed on this issue in that they've allowed the in-the-money creditors to allocate the so-called restructuring surplus pretty much as they wish. But with the rise of contested plans, the justification for out-of-the-money stakeholders retaining value has become much more in focus from a fairness standpoint.
The absolute priority rule does remain a fundamental principle in the States, but That doesn't mean that equity gets wiped every time the valuation breaks at a class that's above the equity. People sometimes forget that the absolute priority rule only applies in a cram down scenario. In other words, when not all classes accept the plan. So in a fully consensual scenario where every class votes to accept the plan, that does not need to be complied with. And we've seen cases in which this was used, especially in prepacs that implement a prepetition deal with creditors that allows equity to retain some or all of its interest.
Now, on the next point, we all know that Chapter 11 isn't a cheap process, and we might have prepack bankruptcies that can be done quickly, but a traditional Chapter 11 can drag on for 8-9 months or even years. How would you generally describe the timing and the costs of your processes abroad, and importantly, who pays the check?
This is a little bit different in the Netherlands. So the WOA process itself can be finalized in 4 to 6 weeks, but this is excluding negotiations and designing the WOA plan, lockups, etc. Also costs. They very much depend on size and complexity, of course. But I think it's fair to say that the WOA is significantly cheaper than a Chapter 11. So costs normally vary from, let's say, 500K to a couple of millions, with exceptions, of course. And the McDermott restructuring is an example of an exceptional, very complex and litigious Dutch WOA, which was combined with a UK RP, which cost about $150 million of total advisor fees. This was actually a specific case, which had complexities that you normally do not see in a cross-border financial restructuring. The debtor pays for the costs of supporting creditor groups, normally, and it is also possible that costs of dissenting creditors must be paid.
In the UK, once the deal is reached and we're ready to launch a process, we could be done within 6 to 8 weeks on the aggressive side, obviously subject to court timetables. So the key from a cost and time standpoint will be the negotiation and the papering of the deal. As we've kind of covered already, schemes and RPs can be surgically designed to only impact the necessary part of the capital structure. So as a result, they can be pretty cost efficient, and the total spend will be driven by the complexity of the deal and the number of parties rather than the process itself, so to speak. The other factors which help keep costs relatively low is that the processes are based on 200-year-old case law. So the universe of new areas for the court to decide on or which can cause delay is really relatively small. The real costs will come if the scheme or the RP is contested, meaning expert witnesses, long hearings, case management conferences, and potential appeal proceedings. That can drive the cost up quite a lot, and often the court will order that the costs of the opposing creditor are paid by the company if the court considers the opposing creditor has valid arguments that will assist the court. And then in terms of numbers, how much does this actually cost? Well, an uncontested scheme for a medium-sized capital structure and perhaps a relatively straightforward deal could be a couple of million on the company side when taking into account both legal and financial advisor fees. It grows from there, depending on the factors already mentioned.
I can't deny that Chapter 11 can be long and expensive, and the cost is mostly borne by the company. But the trend is going in the direction of more efficient cases like prepacs, or at least prearranged cases where the timeline and cost can be contained. So the risk is somewhat manageable, but Chapter 11 is, by its nature, an adversarial process. So even if all major constituents agree on how a company will be restructured and the timeline for such restructuring, our process allows for a dissenting creditor to have its day in court. And oftentimes, that very right is the dissenting creditor's key leverage. But the reality is, as we've heard, that with the rise in popularity of other regimes, those may become more expensive, especially with litigation or added complexity.
So if we're looking at the scoreboard here, it sounds like on the abroad side, we have Chapter 11 beat on time and cost so far. But how about precedent and predictability? In particular, for some of the newer regimes, how well tested are these tools? And are there really any significant cases that can maybe be looked at as to major precedent or trail markers for some of these issues?
Yeah, that's a fair point. So the WOA is new, but I must say in the last 2 years, we've already seen the larger and cross-border companies actually use it for restructuring. The specialized Dutch courts have shown to be very good. And so far, all large cross-border WOAs have been put through successfully. So McDermott, Biocity, Vaughan are examples. And we have a massive amount of case law given the time we have seen the WOA. It's over 300 judgments. And that really helps understanding how the Dutch courts view the various options that the WOA provides. So even though we do not yet benefit from the massive experience that the courts in the UK have for schemes and in the US for Chapter 11, the progress made in the Netherlands in the past years shows that there is a positive outlook for the continued use of the WOA.
In terms of regime, really well tested with a very experienced judicial bench. We're talking about hundreds of years of case law from schemes, which underpins the newer RP process. And in terms of significant precedent, I mean, there are loads of examples of schemes and more recently RPs, Virgin Active, Smile Telecom, Adler, Thames Water, Sino-Ocean. It's a very long list with some really clear and practical guidance within the case law.
Going back to Maya this time, as some of these processes become more durable and predictable, do you think that this could signal a shift away from Chapter 11 when companies have the wherewithal to look outside the US?
I think other systems are certainly raising the bar when it comes to competition, but Chapter 11 remains the most tested and widely used system with the most experienced judges. And predictability is often a key consideration. So I do think that we'll continue to see a number of Chapter 11 cases of both domestic and foreign companies. That said, the systems that we're hearing about today are certainly a very viable alternative, and that may well be the case in situations where non-consensual third-party releases are essential. After the Supreme Court Purdue decision, non-consensual third-party releases are not permitted in the states. But I will say that is in Chapter 11. We recently got the first decisions confirming that they could be enforced through Chapter 15 recognition proceedings, assuming the foreign proceedings allows them, like you'll hear in English proceedings, for example.
Third-party releases, including of guarantees given by non-English guarantors, are really common in English proceedings, as long as certain necessity tests are met, meaning they're needed because they form part of the compromise or arrangement and are essential to the success of the scheme or the RP. So this also means that single entry processes are possible in the UK, distinct from the US, for example. You don't need every company in the capital structure to file in order to benefit from the process. And it's possible, therefore, that this additional flexibility could lead to more US businesses with a European presence or European assets considering an English process, for example, as part of a parallel or sequential proceedings, or as a straight up alternative to Chapter 11, where it may not have done so before, or businesses may think more carefully about choice of law going forward. It will be really situation specific, especially where Chapter 15 recognition is needed.
From a WOA perspective, so the single entry processes are also possible. When it comes to third-party releases, the verdict is still unknown in the Netherlands. So we believe that certain third-party releases should be possible, for example, advisors in relation to the restructuring itself. But the scope of the possibilities is expected to be less wide than in the US and the UK, for example. Also, what we have not seen yet is a WOA where third-party releases were actually tested.
Great. And now we're going to talk a little bit about the relation of all the systems together. So starting with Melissa, let's go to how do foreign companies restructure in your jurisdictions? Tell us how high the bar is.
Well, forum shopping, so to speak, is welcomed in UK processes as long as the court's satisfied based on relevant evidence that the plan or scheme will be effective and recognised where needed in relation to relevant non-UK jurisdictions. And there have been many cases where non-UK companies have moved Comey to England, added an English company to their restricted or main obligor group, or changed governing law of their debt in order to establish the requisite connection to the jurisdiction.
Yeah, also under the WOA, the bar is actually quite low. So a foreign company can use the WOA if it has sufficient connection with the Netherlands, which can be local presence or, for example, governing law of the financing documents. And for example, if we have had the WOA for BioCity, which was a landmark case, it involved a Dutch company with English law governed debt, where the governing law was changed to Dutch law to allow for a WOA to be used for the restructuring. I must, however, add that we are not as developed as the UK when it comes to welcoming forum shopping.
Forum shopping is alive and well in the States, and the threshold to be a Chapter 11 debtor is in fact very low. The company must only have a place of business domicile or property in the States. And property has been interpreted very broadly. It's been enough to have a bank account, a retainer with a US law firm, US governed debt, or causes of action in the States to satisfy this requirement. I will say, though, that while entering Chapter 11 is not much of a hurdle, there are practical considerations. For example, how to enforce the automatic stay and the bankruptcy court orders abroad. If there's no recognition proceedings, and if there may be parties that are not subject to personal jurisdiction. But there's certainly a long history of foreign companies using Chapter 11, and I expect that to continue.
But a restructuring really only works if the plan is recognized and enforced in all of the company's relevant jurisdictions. So can we talk a little bit about recognition? Well, recognition to use the US term for it, starting with Melissa.
In terms of whether there are any recognition challenges in the UK, yes and no. Because of the very old case of Gibbs, which requires English government debt to be restructured only through an English process, English courts will not recognise a foreign compromise of an English contract unless the relevant creditor has specifically consented. Other than that, we live in quite a permissive regime. Gibbs will lead to parallel processes or a situation where the debtor has to assess the facts of the specific case and take a view on the need to recognise in the UK presence of assets, practical ability or likelihood of creditors to obtain an English court judgment and make mischief with it will be the type of factors considered.
Yes, for example, the recognition of the UK RP in the Netherlands, which is considered to be possible but not certain, which actually is the case for the scheme. So, and this is also the reason why the WOA has been used in parallel with UK RPs to deal with the recognition point. And as the processes are relatively similar, it is not too complex to run the process in parallel, and it does not necessarily double the cost.
As far as recognition of foreign processes, Chapter 15 cases have shown that the US courts will be quite deferential to foreign proceedings, including by allowing US government debt to be compromised in a foreign proceeding. But there are some limitations, and it's not yet clear how far the public policy debate will go. As I mentioned, we have seen first cases where the non-consensual third-party releases have been recognized in foreign proceedings, but it will depend on the circumstances of each case.
Now, I've heard that another difference is that directors' duties might have a greater impact on the timing of a filing in non-US jurisdictions. Is that the case?
In a Dutch restructuring, there's quite a lot of flexibility to spend time to find solution for financial difficulties. There's no mandatory insolvency filing requirement. And to use the WOA, you need to show that you expect not to be able to continue to pay your debts. But this can already be the case if you have a maturity date under your financing in 6 to 12 months. So the threshold for established director liability in the Netherlands is quite high, and only real mismanagement leads to personal liability.
There's no insolvency requirement for a scheme, but for an RP, you do need to show financial distress, but it's a pretty low bar, and it can arise from covenant breaches, including even projected breaches. Director liability only is a relevant consideration, usually when there's no reasonable prospect of avoiding insolvent liquidation or administration, and the directors continue to trade without minimizing losses to creditors. Unless they can see the sunlit uplands, which I'm told is a very English phrase, the directors cannot trade, but helpfully the courts do not operate with hindsight. You can be wrong, but not unreasonable. And you will hardly ever be unreasonable if you're properly advised and you follow that advice. In the zone of insolvency, directors should be minimizing losses, reducing cash out, and really seeking an exit.
One of the key benefits of the bankruptcy code in the States is that it does not require any insolvency test to be met for a company to seek relief. But the filing needs to be made in good faith. In this context, the LTL Third Circuit decision seems to introduce the requirement for a so-called financial distress. But there is certainly no threshold or clear rule as to what distress the company needs to be in a bankruptcy process. There's been recent examples where filings were challenged on good faith grounds because the company, in plain terms, was addressing maturities that were relatively far out. But in that particular case, the circumstances still warranted against the dismissal of the case. That may not be the same, of course, in every situation.
All right. And to bring things kind of to a bookend here, we've spoken about the recent evolution of some of the restructuring and insolvency processes outside of the US. So very briefly, give us a wish list item or two that you'd really like to see in your jurisdiction, or if you'd like to expand more broadly into Europe, go for it.
For the UK, it's quite simple. I'd like to see a moratorium for large cap structures with a dip regime. That would be great.
I think for the Netherlands, what I hope for is more case law, showing that the WOA can be an effective tool to restructure both Dutch and international companies. And what I do not hope is for more aggressive litigation around the WOA, because that could make it less interesting to use.
For Chapter 11, I would love to borrow the English scheme or RP mechanism where you can apply a surgical restructuring to just certain classes of debt or equity.
Excellent. And I'm sure that on all points, there are plenty of our listeners and or readers that would agree with you on each one of those requests. So we'll take it right to the courts and put it in the request box. That brings us to the close of our conversation today. So I'd like to thank all of you so very much for coming on and sharing your time and your expertise with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And thank you, as always, to our listeners for checking out this episode of Legal Lens. You can follow us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And as always, you can check out plenty of analysis on DebtWire's website. My name is Andy Serby, and I'll see you next time.